fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, Charlotte. How are you doing up in Missouri, okay?
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for asking.
We have one of the finest guests tonight, Susan Lindauer, and she's got quite a story. And I'm going to bring her on and let her introduce herself to our audience and tell her, you know, our audience a little bit about her, and then we'll start into her story. Welcome to our program, Susan Lindauer.
Thank you very much. I really am grateful for the opportunity to talk with you. This is such an important moment of our history, where we're figuring out the next direction that we're going in. And I should tell you all, I am a huge Trump supporter. So I will preface this by saying,
well, we are too, Susan. We are too.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Well,
because I a lot of what I'm seeing right now that happened to me is running parallel to what they're trying to do to President Trump. So I'm going to try to put my story in the context of explaining what the deep state is doing to him and how incredibly outrageous it is, and how my story is sort of a trial run for that.
Well, you first got introduced, what, into politics, what, in 1993? Was that where you first began to
I was an intelligence asset, a CIA and defense intelligence asset from and I covered Iraq and Libya at the United Nations. I did the Lockerbie negotiations. I did the weapons inspections talks with Iraq. I did so many good things that should have deserved to be credited. And were, at the time that I did them, they were credited. I was actually considered to be very respectable and very reputable, very trustworthy, had a lot of integrity. I achieved results. Then my team gave advance warning about 9/11 and negotiated the return of the weapons inspectors and a peace option, a peace framework that with Iraq that got... The CIA was able to, the Iraqi government was very determined to have peace. So they had weapons inspections with no conditions. They agreed to allow the FBI to send a terrorism task force into Iraq with authority to conduct terrorism investigations, interview witnesses, and make arrests. And contracts for American corporations. The CIA was very aggressive about demanding, making sure that Iraq would not punish the United States in any period after sanctions. So they were making all kinds of extraordinary demands. The Iraqis agreed to give preferential contracts to U.S. corporations in healthcare, hospital equipment, and pharmaceuticals because its healthcare system had been decimated by sanctions. They offered the United States preferential contracts on telecommunications, farm equipment, transportation, including they offered to buy 1 million American manufactured automobiles every year for 10 years. And I laughed. And they said, well, we'll make it 20 years.
My God, really?
I was like,
there's a power there, isn't there? Wasn't there a power that you had in negotiating these things?
Oh, yes, yes. My cousin was the chief of staff to George Bush, Andrew Card. And I had been you know, I'd been doing all this work for many years before George Bush was in the office. It was elected to the White House. In fact, our talks on the weapons inspection started while the votes were being counted in Florida, and they were debating the hanging chads. And so I was already in the meetings with the Iraq's ambassador at the Iraqi embassy. Everything had been approved. But, you know, I was not just going out there and just doing this on my own. It had been approved at the highest levels of government. The idea was to hand a victory to the new president, whoever it was, whether it was Republican or Democrat, Al Gore or George Bush. And George Bush had said all through the campaign he opposed an interventionist policy in Iraq. And so this all looked like, you know, we were going to do something really great. Oil, the Iraqis promised the United States preferential contracts in all new oil development and leasing, and promised to use only U.S. equipment for replacing the pipelines and the pumping stations. So it would have been every field, including oil, every sector of the economy that you could have imagined, farming, transportation, telecommunication.
My gosh. What went wrong in here? I mean, things were going so well. What happened that upset the apple cart here? What was going on behind the scenes?
Insane. We saw that this was before social media. I am convinced that if the internet, you know, this was, the internet was very young. Now for young people, you know, they don't remember the life without the internet.
Right.
And they're used to social media where they can communicate and share documents and primary sourcing. That did not exist at this period. It was very, that was all brand new. We trusted, biggest mistake of our lives. We trusted the Washington Post and the New York Times. We believed in ABC News would never lie to us. Before Dan Rather, we were shocked, just shocked.
My God, things have changed so much, haven't they?
Oh, yes. You know, we know better now. But we believe them. And if they told us something, we would just say, well, you said it must be true. I better obey you. And, you know, I was, of course, I was the eye of the storm. That means that I was standing at the eye of the hurricane, and I could turn any 360 degrees and see exactly what was really going on with clear detail. I knew everything that, you know, on the very day that the first hours after Senator John McCain requested to interview Al Anai, the Iraqi diplomat who allegedly had a meeting in Prague with Mohammed Atta, one of the masterminds of 9/11. That very day, I was in the Iraqi embassy meeting with an Iraqi delegation, and they swore to me, you can have that meeting, we'll send the FBI immediately. You know, Iraq had agreed to allow the FBI to come into Baghdad in February of 2001. And I had been ordered by my CIA handler in April of 2001, 6 months before 9/11, to go to the Iraqis and warn them and threaten them that we demanded they hand over any intelligence on this conspiracy involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. And we demanded they hand that information over to us, and if they didn't, we'd bomb them. And I went up to the New York and to the embassy and talked to my diplomats, and I said, hey, guys, need you to send a cable to Baghdad, because the Iraqis were so cooperative. They hated jihadists more than we did. They were deeply concerned that religious fanatics would take over their country and prey upon the poverty and the instability and the lack of centralized control. So they were very hyper attuned to what was going on. And this was one thing that they wanted Washington to know, that they would be the best ally in the whole Middle East. They would be our best ally in fighting terrorism. So before 9/11, you know, for years, Saddam gave great intelligence on terrorism. And we had known in advance about the bombing of the USS Cole. And after the bombing of the USS Cole in October of 2000, thanks because of the Iraqis told us about it. I told the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA and also the Yemeni ambassador, who was a friend of mine, about the USS Cole. We knew, everybody knew, that it was going to happen. And yet, the military, the commander of the USS Cole, stood down basic precautionary measures which are in place for basic protocols of security that are in place for every ship that lands and docks in a foreign port. There are requirements. All of those were removed that night. And we knew, I had warned them a week, it was only a week before, but I had warned them about the attack. And they stood it down anyway.
My God.
And then the United States, you see, and then the United States used that USS Cole attack as an excuse to require Yemen to allow the U.S. military to set up a base in Aden, in Yemen. Okay?
Yes.
So they knew it was coming, and they used it for something. And this is the history of false flags. Now, in that case, I'm not trying to say that Yemen was not a real terrorist attack. It was. It absolutely was. But we knew about it, and we let it happen.
Right.
And in the case of 9/11, we not only knew about it and let it happen, we did let it happen, but we also made it happen.
Right.
And that is the thing, that the buildings were hardwired with explosives. We all knew it was going to come down. We talked about, I all through the summer of 2001, I repeatedly had conversations with the Iraqis about the 9/11 attack. And I even told friends who testified in federal court when I was arrested on the Patriot Act, testified that I told them very clearly, very specifically, that the attack would happen at the end of August or early September. And that in the month of August, I warned people, and apparently I did this, I didn't even remember all the people who I had told. They're like, I remember. My brother was like, I remember too. I was getting on the subway in New York, and I was going down the subway stairs, down the escalator, and I'm listening to you tell me about this attack that's going to happen. And it was, and you said there was going to be an attack on the World Trade Center involving airplanes hijackings and something kind of strike on the World Trade Center. I thought you were nuts. And now I see it, and the first thing I saw when I saw those planes hit the towers was I thought of you.
Oh, man.
And you knew. You know, and it was like my friends were like, oh, yes, it's true. And it was so definitive. The kinds of witnesses I had were so definitive. It's like, yes, I remember exactly where I was when you told me about this attack. And as soon as I saw the attack, I immediately thought of your warning. Okay? So this is kind of these are people who are, you know, very, very credible people. And so if they, you know, when we finally got into court, and the New York Times wrote a story that day, they testified to this, and the New York Times wrote a story saying that I was a religious maniac. Now, I do believe in God. I absolutely
right.
do. That's factually true. Absolutely, I do. They said she's a maniac. She hallucinates. She has religious hallucinations. She believes in angels. She believes in divine intervention. I do believe in angels. Yeah, I do.
They tried to discredit you and make you into a conspiracy idiot or something, right?
Yeah. But they also tried to make me seem like I was like this, like literally insane,
delusional, and crazy.
Insane.
I got you.
Like totally insane. Like I'm like you. I couldn't have a conversation with you because I'd be talking about So I had been sent. Anyway, that I'm giving you the background on
yeah,
this.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want everybody to understand that these warnings were not just shared with the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. You see, I talked to friends and I talked to family about it. I told everybody, stay out of New York. You know, the end of August, early September, stay out of New York. We're expecting an attack. I was very precise about what was going to happen, what the target would be,
right,
how it would be down, that it had something that they were going to try to, that they were trying to connect it to Iraq, and that we were, and that the Iraqis were denying it. On September 8th, on September 2nd, excuse me, not September 8th, sorry, August 2nd,
okay,
the day of Robert Mueller's Senate confirmation hearing, I was at an office, not at my home, I was on a consulting job, and from that consulting job, I had a phone conversation with my CIA handler, and we said, oh, there's never been a case, there's never been a terrorism case this guy Robert Mueller didn't throw. And he said, oh, which one are you thinking about? Oh, Oklahoma City. It was Robert Mueller who said that there was only that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols had no help. Well, of course, now we know that Terry Nichols was traveling to the Philippines and having meetings with the guy from the first World Trade Center attack, Ramzi Youssef.
Right.
And we know that he was over there at Abu Sayyaf University in one of the areas having where there's a lot of Islamic activism, jihadists in the Philippines. Who knew? Apparently, we all knew, you know, Robert Mueller knew, and they covered it up and said that it was a local conspiracy theory, local conspiracy, you know, Waco related nutcases kind of thing. And it was a cover-up to stop the real facts coming out about, you know, about the early Al-Qaeda influence. The Al-Zawahiri was the guy. Al-Zawahiri was the sheikh from the south of Egypt who was trying to overthrow Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. So, you know, this is, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. But that's August 2nd. On August 2nd, my CIA handler and I had a conversation talking about Robert Mueller, what a disaster he would be.
So that early, you had a pretty good heads up on Mueller at that time, right?
Absolutely. And on August 4th, I told my CIA handler, I said, I'm going to go up to New York one last time and ask one last time if they've got any intelligence on the Iraq, on the World Trade Center attack. And he said, I think it's dangerous. I think you shouldn't go because I don't want you, you know, the attack is imminent and we're all saying the attack is imminent. So I said, well, I'm going to go up one last time. Came back, made a report to him on August 6th at his office in Great Falls, Virginia. And he says to me, and we said, okay, what are we going to do? We cannot be passive. And I said, I will call the Attorney General, John Ashcroft. I have a phone number that goes straight into his office, and I will call John Ashcroft's office and report this as a direct warning and seeking an emergency, what they call an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies seeking any fragment of intelligence involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center as a known target with a possible miniature thermonuclear device. We always expected the buildings to get blown up. It never occurred, now before the attack, it never occurred to me that we would be the ones blowing up the buildings. Because we always thought that the bad guys would blow up the buildings.
Yeah, in other words, the Saudis that were brought in were fall guys, you know. They were just the scapegoats, right?
They were scapegoats. They were patsies.
Now, who helped bring them in? From what I can tell, David Edger. He was Berlin Desk CIA before that, and it looked like that he knew about Mohammed Atta in Hamburg. But it looked like that they were coordinating those Saudis to bring them in to take the fall on this 9/11. That's what it looks like to me.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it was an official story that, you know, if you have a conspiracy, you have to have an event, you have to have something that you can point to. It's like a magician's trick.
Right.
It's the way I look at it, it is very much like a magician's trick. All eyes are on the airplanes. on the left, while the real action is the explosives on the right, but it's the fake, it fakes you out, and it gives you, it creates enough cognitive dissonance.
A diversion away from.
Diversion.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, the airplane hit the building. Yeah. Gosh, and now the building fell down. Yeah. Oh my goodness, yeah. How did that
exactly
happen?
And the people were traumatized.
What the heck is that all about?
Charlotte and I interviewed Fran Schur, who'd written 20 articles, and they have to do with the psychology of 9/11, and they're really insightful, and this was like a trauma-based programming thing that happened, event for the American public, it appeared to me.
Oh, I think so. So by August 8th.
Okay.
By August 8th, I personally telephoned the office of Attorney General John Ashcroft and asked him to do that. Asked their people to do that, and the guy told me before he hung up the phone, he said, "Listen, I want you to hang up the phone. I want you to call this number at the Office of Counterterrorism. You should repeat that message exactly as you gave it to me." Because, you see, I was saying I'm dealing with Iraq and Libya, and I'm warning there's going to be an attack, and I need you to make an emergency broadcast alert for this attack.
Right.
I'm speaking now to you as an asset who covers Iraq and Libya. You need to do this right now.
Right.
I did. I was totally right. Totally right. And unfortunately, they did not listen to me. I'm told that after they hung up the phone, John Ashcroft was told, and he said, "Oh, those CIA, they're always talking about this attack. Never mind, ignore them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tragedy. Absolute tragedy.
Well, David Boren is sitting at the table with Tenet the morning of 9/11. And Boren had sat on the committee, intelligence committee, longest chairman. And I mean, it was just key figures like that you can't ignore. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know.
And what you came along. Well, Anthony Schaefer was working the ABLE intelligence operation.
ABLE
Danger. And he was alerted to this. And then there was an FBI agent that Charlotte and I interviewed a while back out of Minneapolis office. She got on to some of this too, but it never went anywhere. See, they were ignored, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. They were ignored. That's the point. There's something about the deep state, but I and that's a good moment. Do we have to take a break or anything?
No, we can go straight on through. We've got 57 minutes and 44 seconds to
okay.
Elaborate on this, Susan.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I ended up. Oh no, go ahead.
Susan, would you care to elaborate about the title of the book, of your book, and where people can go to read your account of this as well?
Absolutely, thank you. My book is called Extreme Prejudice, and you can get it on Amazon. And I urge everyone, there's so much information that I'm not able to share in such a short period of time. After all of this was done, I ended up getting arrested. To cut to the chase,
right.
I got arrested on the Patriot Act. And I had requested to testify on Capitol Hill. I went through all the proper channels to do it. And 30 days after I contacted Trent Lott's office and John McCain's office, because the thing is, if you want to testify, those are the people you had to talk to.
Right.
And I wanted to do this properly. I wanted to share what really happened with Iraqi pre-war intelligence and 9/11. And I had a lot of, I was the one who knew everything.
Right.
And 30 days after I requested to testify, I woke up to hear the FBI pounding on my door. With a warrant for my arrest on the Patriot Act. And they, apparently Ahmed Shalabi had forged a couple of very puny, dumb, alleged receipts, saying that, one of them said, a diplomat, they had the diplomat's name. A diplomat gave me $100 for train fare on December 5th, 2000, whatever, on December 5th, 2002. Now, here was the thing. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that's a forgery, and it's a bad one, because the diplomat's name was wrong. I didn't spell it correctly. So you're saying that it was like the name was Salih, and I called him Salah. Well, I know the Arab. I would never call the person the wrong name. That's just dumb.
Right.
That's a stupid thing. And the diplomat who allegedly gave me $100 had left the country in March, and he was 6,000 miles away in December. Okay, so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go into court, and we're going to have a debate over whether he came to New York by a magic carpet, or like flew in on a magic carpet and escaped NORAD to come in land, and you know, or did we do an I Dream of Genie?
Right, right.
Where we have like this magic genie in a bottle, and did I like rub the genie bottle, and then he came out and said, "Oh, here's $100."
Yeah, right. So what they did, they framed you up with this fake $100 kickback or whatever, payoff or whatever, right?
$100, yeah. For heaven's sakes. And it was so dumb.
Right.
I said, that's not even the cost of airfare. And I had emails, communications with a different embassy, a diplomat from Malaysia, because I was dealing with lots of different embassies and diplomats. And he was leaving the country to go back to Malaysia, and he said, well, can you come? He asked me to come to New York in early December. I said, no, I'm not able to come till like 2 weeks later to New York.
Right.
So I wasn't even in New York, and I had a paper trail to prove it. So the whole thing stupid, beyond stupid. And we're talking about $100 here. So it was a bad forgery, and it was just a stupid forgery. So what happens is, I said, I categorically deny receiving any money from the Iraqis, and I will fight you, and I will beat you to a pulp.
Right.
I demand a jury trial, and wait till the jury sees that you're trying to send me to prison for 30 years because of this stupid forgery.
Right.
And I will take the stand. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to beat you like a dog.
Right.
You're not going to be able to crawl away.
You're a fighter, Susan. I like that.
I am a fighter.
You are. You've got spunk, you know?
You're going to be darn sorry. You're going to be darn sorry you messed with me for $100 forgery,
right,
by Ahmed Chalabi.
Right.
And so, but then something else happened, which is, you know, there were three constituencies, because I was the real Iraqi pre-war intelligence, and I was the real 9/11 intelligence. So there are three groups. That had to be concerned. One is the military. And I was a defense intelligence agent, asset. Okay? And the thing is, once soldiers are on the ground, my obligations to secrecy and you keeping your mouth shut in total obedience are absolute ironclad. And I know that, especially when men are dying.
Right.
Okay, they're getting their arms and legs blown off. They're separated from their families. They're going through divorces. And so I knew why I had to stay quiet, or I would have come out guns blazing right from the beginning. But the military gave my boyfriend a job at the Pentagon. He was living with me.
Right.
And here I was being an accused Iraqi agent. And my boyfriend worked at the Pentagon with a top secret security clearance. And generals would send home messages saying, please be quiet, please be quiet. This would be devastating if anyone hears what really happened. Because they have recruitment, they have soldier morale, they have recruitment. They were in a bitter death fight by this stage with the Iraqi insurgency, and how American soldiers are perceived by the enemy, how the occupied people perceive the American soldiers, affects the outcome of the war. And at that point, because I was a defense intelligence asset, I really did have to stay quiet.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yeah, yeah. I go back with the Army Security Agency to West Berlin in 65, And Charlotte is a veteran also coming out of what, the South Command, Charlotte? Is that right?
Oh, no, you saw so. And that was my Army service, and then my Navy was just fix a nuclear submarine.
Oh, okay,
so.
Yeah. So we're both best, but we have some background. Yeah.
Once soldiers are on the ground, you've got to think their safety
sure.
becomes the highest
sure,
priority.
Sure.
Okay, and here's the thing: I was the real thing. I was the person I was saying I was. So I had that burden. If I was not really who I say I am, I wouldn't have had that problem.
Right.
But I was.
I got you.
Now the other thing is, and they all said, you know, write your book after the war is over. Write your book when it's all done. Once we're no longer in danger, then you can tell your story.
Right.
But it wasn't the military who attacked me. Then they come to the second group of people.
Okay.
The politicians.
Okay.
And those were the cowards and the liars.
Right.
They had forced our world into war, and they lacked the courage and integrity. I despise them.
Right.
Despise them in ways you cannot imagine.
Right.
They lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for their decisions, so they wanted to blame somebody else for their mistakes and their stupidity, and they decided to blame the intelligence community. And at the same time, two things happened. Colin Powell, who should be court-martialed, went out and he gave an interview I was free on bail for 18 months, and everybody expected my case to go away. The military was like, look, she knows to be quiet, this shouldn't have happened, leave her alone, and I thought it was over. And instead what happened is that Colin Powell, right at that moment, you should all listen to this interview. On September 8th, Colin Powell gave an interview to Barbara Walters on 2020. And it's the fake news at its finest. And he accused he said he was talking about his speech at the United Nations and how nobody came to warn him that it was bad intelligence and he should not have been listening to those people because they were big forgers and fabricators, and why didn't anybody mid-level should have warned him? Well, I did warn him twice.
Okay.
And this jerk, Colin Powell, had turned over my papers to the FBI, and that's why I was being prosecuted. Was because it was to protect Colin Powell. So on September, this is so hideous.
It is.
On September 8th, Colin Powell gave his interview. On September 17th, the Justice Department rubber stamped an order that I was, quote, not competent to stand trial. On September 23rd, I was ordered to go into court and ambushed. They call it a status hearing, just to find out, you know, what's going on in the case. So I show up in court, and I am ambushed. They told me that I had been declared not competent to stand trial, and I would no longer have the right to have a trial, and I would be forced to surrender to prison without a trial or a hearing. I was not even allowed to have a hearing.
Oh my God!
And the law says that you must have a hearing. And I said, I want a hearing. And they said, if you demand a hearing prior to your prison sentence, then we shall, you shall lose your bail effective immediately, and your bail will be revoked until after the case is over. And that could be for, you know, heaven only knows.
Forever. I mean, this endless, yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
They said, or you can surrender voluntarily to prison, and you can serve your prison term, and after you get out of prison, then we'll talk about the hearing.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
That swamp is swampy,
isn't it? Bad.
That's swampy.
Yeah.
But what you're seeing is what exactly the parallels of what they're doing to President Trump. You've got the fake intelligence. You've got the felony perjury, that dossier, that dirty dossier.
Oh, yeah, the golden shower thing. Yeah.
Golden, which was done by Ukrainians.
Yes,
they keep lying this. It was done by the Ukrainians who did it.
Yeah, you make a good point, Susan. With all the social networking and the internet, all this stuff is harder to suppress and hide, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And then WikiLeaks figures into it and all that other stuff, see? So
that's right.
It's blown the lid off of their secrets, hidden little mechanizations.
Absolutely. It's really, we are in a position of power and strength, and I hope I ask everyone, please be merciful with President Trump. He is being smashed and slammed on all sides. He's trying to figure out what to do, and he's a businessman. The best part of him is that he knows he's a fighter and a survivor. And he's dealt with bankrupt companies all of his life, and let's be honest, we, the United States Treasury, are bankrupt.
Right.
We are. And he's probably, I believe, truly, he's the best president that we could have at this point, and God help us if Hillary Clinton had won. We dodged a bullet.
Right.
Listening to this horrible woman and all of her rationalizations and crazy talk, I would despair for the future of this country. But we have got to help President Trump.
Right. I agree with that. One little...
People, I'm horrified about the DACA. I don't want the DACA. I don't want the... I refuse to call them dreamers. They're illegal aliens. They came here as children. They need to be removed.
Okay.
Most of them are criminals. I guess I won't go off on that.
Yeah, let me put a little idea here on the table to better, so that our listening audience and everyone can better understand Trump. Trump is a pragmatist. His philosophy is pragmatism. He doesn't have nearly the same principles and so forth of abandon or other people that you would identify as a patriot type thinker. See what I mean? That's why he's willing to cross over and make deals based on a very pragmatic outcome. Okay? That's really where he's coming from at times.
Well, I tell you, it's a shame.
Yeah.
It is a tragedy that the Republican establishment refuse to get on board with him and help him.
Exactly.
They are blocking his agenda. They're blocking any. They have the power. They could push through all of his judges, and it should be done.
Right.
Okay. Trump has already nominated 29 judges. He's got 123 openings. He's nominated 29 already. And McConnell is playing games. Paul Ryan is playing games. I will tell you, in the last 10 minutes of our show,
right,
I have been working on recovering stolen federal money. Because of my book, and everybody read Extreme Prejudice,
okay,
because then you'll find out what I suffered when I was at Carswell Air Force Base. It was the most terrifying experience of my life. But when David Petraeus was CIA director, somebody in his office, God bless him, threw me a bone. And it was to recover stolen federal money. They knew that I was keyed into 9/11 and all hyped up about 9/11. And the $2.3 trillion, remember the day before 9/11?
Yes,
I know where that money is. And the man who has it is a Chinese agent. Now, remember, if you read Extreme Prejudice, you'll know I was accused of being an Iraqi agent. So David Petraeus, extremely brilliant strategist, on the ground, planning, thinking. I admire him a lot. Whether you all like him or not, I admire him a lot. And I credit him with giving me this, or his people with giving me this. This is a Chinese agent who has the money. He is a federal inmate. He has been in prison since 1999. I'm not going to tell you his name because he is very gifted at making mischief and going out and creating alliances and manipulating people to interact with his stolen federal money. He is holding the $2.3 trillion is, we have the capability to get it back with about $6 or $7 trillion dollars in earnings for about a total of $8 to $9 or $10 trillion U.S. dollars.
Oh my God.
Trump has the capability to cut the federal deficit by half. Okay? And in addition to that, there is separately $1 trillion at Citibank. Separate from that.
Right.
And the thing is, remember how Hillary Clinton got like 800,000, I don't know how much, she got hundreds of thousands of dollars from Citibank as campaign contributions.
Okay.
Well, Citibank did not want to give up this money. And so they were giving Hillary Clinton a lot of money. Well, then Hillary Clinton, and they thought Hillary would win, and they'd march off into the sunset, but she lost.
Right.
And now Trump, so now I'm trying very, very hard to get the bureaucracy motivated, moving. Motivated is not the word, but the deep state, we have the capability to get $1 trillion back. It will pay for the infrastructure investment. The bonds from the infrastructure investment could easily double the veterans' pensions for every single veteran who's collecting a pension. We do have the capability to double the pensions. And so what I've been fighting with, and Trump knows about this, and Trump wants to get the money back. We are battling the deep state to make the deep state get this money back. And frankly, I'm bitterly disappointed. They could have done this already, but General Kelly, I hope and pray. I pray, and all of us should pray, because I talk about like, yeah, I do believe in God. General Kelly is going to have the force of will to compel the bureaucracy to do its job, and then we're going to get the money back, and all kinds of good things are possible. So the first 6 months has been very rocky for President Trump, but we're now into a state where our issue of the $1 trillion is on the, we're fighting to make them do it. Trump wants it. I'm doing everything I can to help make them do it. And we're running into the deep state resistance. But we're going to force this through. And it's going to change everything. And that will make the once we get the $1 trillion, we can leverage the $1 trillion for the $2.3 trillion. And there's a strategy for doing that. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but we do know how to do it. The $1 trillion is critical. Once we've got the $1 trillion, then we've got the leverage that we need, for reasons I'm not going to explain, to get the $2.3 trillion plus earnings. We can cut the federal deficit by half and get tax reform in the next 12 months.
Oh, my God.
This administration is not over.
Right.
But, again, the deep state sees the potential victory. I'm against the DACA. I'm against the whole using that word dreamer offends me. I believe in strong, very strong immigration enforcement. So that's just who I am.
Okay, that's fair enough. We know where you're coming from. Yeah, I can. Those promises made by Barack Obama under that. It was unconstitutional to start with, you know.
That's right.
He committed an unconstitutional act to start with, and gave those people a lot of hope and so forth. See.
And we don't owe them welfare and special subsidies for them to get an education. We don't owe them anything, and frankly, we can't afford it.
Yeah,
and until we can take care of our own people, we need to stop taking care of everybody else.
Well, Rumsfeld announced the day before 9/11 about that money missing from the Pentagon, did he not? You know, and
yes, and that's what was bothering.
Go ahead, Charlotte. What do you have? What do you say, Charlotte?
I was agreeing. Yes, it was Rumsfeld. Yes, I remember.
And then was not the accounting office the office that the so-called missile or something, you know, went into and blew up? Wasn't that the accounting office
Yes, indeed.
Huh?
Yes, indeed. That's right.
So that's suspicious, see? And, you know, we think it was a cruise missile, but I don't know what your ideas are, would be on it.
I think it's a missile.
Yeah.
I think it's a missile.
Those five steel photographs would indicate something went through there very quickly, you know, that was small. And low to the ground, you know. So, and the initial
hold. Well, you know, I think it's interesting that we are. I know we're coming to the end of the show,
right.
or maybe not because we started late.
We have another 15 minutes, basically.
Okay. Good. Well, the thing is, you know, I just want to say to everybody that it's not America is not over, and I we're not finished. We do not have to end up in the toilet bowl of history, but it is 10 minutes to midnight.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It is ten minutes to midnight, and we need to think very carefully about the choices and the decisions we're making. We can no longer do business the way we have. And I want everybody to know that even though I have suffered, I was locked up in Carswell Air Force Base, and it was like my own private Guantanamo.
What was that like, Susan? What happened there? What was going on?
It was absolutely terrifying. Going back to Colin Powell,
right.
He gives an interview on September 8th. September 23rd, I'm ambushed in court. On October 3rd, I am ordered to surrender to prison.
Right.
And I was originally supposed to be there only for 4 months because that's what the statute says. And once I got in there, they refused to let me go. And it was the scariest thing I've ever. They actually argued that I should be forcibly drugged with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac until I stopped saying that I was an intelligence asset who gave advance warning about 9/11. And so they actually and all kind. It was the most terrifying experience of my life. I have fought harder than anything I've ever fought in my life. It involved felony perjury and forged documents and massive prosecutorial misconduct. I had a public defender while I was locked up, and he just wanted to get rid of my case. He didn't care what happened to me, and I was like, I am not going to, you know, put drugs in my body because some politician is afraid to face voters that he couldn't handle, you know, the decision on his powers of a member of Congress and when he, you know, forcing our country into war, and that scumbag Colin Powell should be court-martialed. He should be court-martialed for lying to his fellow officers, lying to his lower enlisted personnel.
Subordinates.
Yeah.
He lied, and it was a terrible lie. He violated his oath to protect the Constitution and uphold the rights of all citizens, which, you know, my rights are being sacrificed so that he can try to whitewash the blood and guts of American soldiers off his uniform. But of course, like I said, at that point, 2005, 2006, men were dying in Iraq. And 2006 was the bloodiest year of the insurgency. I think Fallujah was right at that point.
Okay, I'm not sure. I think
Fallujah was right at that point, and General Kelly and he had to go into Fallujah and clean it up. And you know, they had very good reasons. The military did for wanting me to keep my mouth shut, and I respect that. I would never want to put any soldier in danger, and I could have. During those two or three years when it was really, really bad, and they could have been, you know, if my stuff had come out right at that moment, it would have been a catastrophe. And I love the military, and I would never want to do anything that would, you know, they went after Chelsea Manning for like 30, Bradley Manning with a 35 year sentence, I think it was. And in fact, what I knew was far more devastating than anything that Chelsea Manning knew. Chelsea Manning may have released, you know, a couple hundred thousand, you know, classified emails, and that's certainly bad. That's certainly bad. But what I knew was, you know, would have been at that moment.
You had first person knowledge of a lot of different people interacting in concerning some very, very sensitive issues. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I was a primary actor
yes.
in built in those situations, and it would have been, you know, my testimony would have changed on Capitol Hill, would have certainly
changed the war, wouldn't it? It would have
changed the war, but it would have changed, it would have stopped everything. And the thing is, I came back after in the 6 months before the invasion, I was all over Congress telling them not to do it.
Right.
I took the peace option to every single, knocking on everybody's doors, sitting in their offices, you know, door to door to door, saying, don't do this, don't do this, this is a mistake, here's a peace option, we can execute this, we can make this happen.
Right.
Look at all the things we're going to get. The CIA drove a hard bargain and Iraq agreed to everything. And between that and the success of the weapons inspections, which I also negotiated. I mean, I think that the hardest part for me is that I should be respected. And people should, even if you supported the war or disagree with my private politics, you know, I should be known as somebody who's a reputable person. And instead what I am known for, if you check Wikipedia, it is an obscenity. I am a traitor. Maybe I engaged in espionage.
You were a wheeler dealer. You went through back channels and then you were a little bit crazy or delusional. That's what they come
crazy
up
with. Crazy or insane or
yeah. Discredited person. Yeah.
A discredited person. They've tried to say, I can't even look at Wikipedia, but at one point they did try to say that I was a religious maniac, and maybe it's gotten better so that they don't say that anymore. I don't know. Don't even bother to call me and send me an email. Here's what Wikipedia says. I don't want to know.
Right.
I do not want to know. We have tried to fix it so many times, and the next more, and it is locked in. And when we try to, changing my birthday on Wikipedia required my attorney to send my birth certificate.
Okay.
And Wikipedia will allow any moron who doesn't know me to say anything bad about me on Wikipedia based on what the New York Times said.
That's the authority, isn't it?
God help us if we have real intelligence and I have to show my birth certificate to prove that it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's to straighten out, at least get my birth date right on Wikipedia. And that's about the only thing I think that's accurate.
Yeah, boy, it's crazy, isn't it?
And it took hell to get it done. So the things I did were really good things. And, you know, really good things and should have been respected. And deserve to be respected, and I really hope that I'm pulling for President Trump. I want him to get this money back for America, and I'm going, and if there's any spook listening to this, I am going to be ferocious about it because I'm going to continue to be ferocious about it. We've already brought $87 billion back. Of stolen federal money. Think about that.
My God.
From this one individual who is in federal prison, $87 billion. And now we have the $1 trillion. And then we're going to get the $1 trillion. We'll leverage the $2.3 trillion. And we're just running into obstacles all over the place. The bureaucracy, they're sabotaging President Trump. They are fighting his agenda. They're fighting to stop him from having this victory. Though it means that, yes, we can have infrastructure investment. President Trump will be capable of delivering that with no deficit spending. And we will be able to have tax reform without blowing up the economy because we're going to get the $2.3 trillion plus earnings, about $8 to $9 trillion, and our federal deficit's going to be cut in half. I'm a fighter to the death, and that's where I'm in the battle mode right now.
Right today.
Today we're in battle mode.
Right. Well, what would be some of your final comments and suggestions and advice that you would give to the Americans at large, you know, just the public? We have about 5 minutes left in the program. And Susan, what kind of advice would you give? And Charlotte, I want you to make some comments too on this, okay?
We like to end our program, Susan, with solutions and upbeat, positive recommendations. You know, Anna, it sounds like you've got a lot to say about what Trump is accomplishing, and I love hearing it. So the more you can elaborate on that, it'd be great.
Well, let me tell you, in the next year, and things always take a little bit longer than you think it's going to take. For example, we should have had this money back right at this moment. It should have been done by October 1st. And I've reached out to General Kelly with paperwork and I'm not going to give all the details, but three times this week alone. But President Trump, we have the money at Citibank comes off time deposit in December. Okay? So President Trump has timed his three-month extension of the debt ceiling to December when this money comes off. You didn't know that, but your listeners will be the first to know.
Oh, thank you, Susan. That's great.
Okay. Yes. So it's there's actually a reason why he did it that is not common, that nobody knows about. But we're going to get the money back, and we've got to insist that it go for infrastructure. And America first, we've got to fight for this, make America great again, and rebuild our own economy. The biggest problem that I'm having right now is that the military really wants this money too. Lockheed Martin says, oh my God, you've got $1 trillion. How much of that can I take?
Right.
Oh, I can.
Everybody wants to grab hold of it, don't they?
They all want to grab hold of it, and we've got to keep it for Trump, and I'm begging General Kelly. I've contacted him three times this week alone, sending over papers to the White House of what has to happen so that we can protect this money. And once that's done, the deep state cannot burn it, cannot mess with it, cannot screw it up and hurt us, and we're going to move. And once I truly believe and hope that General Kelly will have the capability, he has the experience and he knows how to move a bureaucracy, and hopefully he is going to be able to deliver and perform and just set things in motion and keep and know, he'll know when to beat them back. And if, you know, when they start to go off track, he can push back and get it moving back where it needs to be. And this should happen. And Trump's vision is very real. But I want everybody to know that we are all making a difference right now. We defeated Hillary Clinton. And it was a tremendous victory for all of us. And we need to stand with President Trump and fight, because the deep state is a bitter enemy of this man.
Right.
They are a bitter enemy. They're hurting. They're selfish. They only think in terms of their next paycheck. And they would be happy to burn this money in a heartbeat, and it would be gone.
Right. You know, one of the positive things about 9/11 that occurred this last anniversary was there was a 9/11 movie showing, or a series of documentaries, and I'm thinking San Francisco. But anyway, the people that showed up there were from the top to the bottom of the social spectrums. And so there are people, just the average person, is getting to wake up to some of these 9/11 things and so forth now, truth, you know?
Yes, I think that it has definitely reached critical mass.
Yes.
It's a critical mass, and people know that the 9/11 story just is a lie,
right.
And they know that there were explosives used on that day. It was a demolition, and they're no longer accepting, they're no longer tolerating the lie.
Charlotte, do you have any final words here before we sign off?
Yeah, Yeah, I just want to thank Susan very much for joining us. It was fascinating to hear your story, Susan, and I know our listening audience will appreciate all your hard work. And thank you, George, for having me on tonight, too.
Okay. Charlotte, thank you a lot. And thank you very much, Susan Lindauer, for being with us this evening. We certainly appreciate all your hard work. Okay?
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.